Well, this evening, dear brethren and sisters, we continue with our series in the Acts, the seventh in the series, and we are to study chapters 21 to 23, verse 10, Paul's last visit to Jerusalem. It's to be given by Brother Graham Lake. And Brother Graham has asked that we read together from the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 21. With that reading, we'll ask our Brother Graham Lake, please, to come forward to give us his address, Acts chapters 21 to 23, verse 10, Paul's last visit to Jerusalem.
My dear brethren and sisters, the year is AD 57 or 58, some 4 years after Nero has come to power in Rome. And the time and the place that we are considering, of course, is Jerusalem. Thank you. A few weeks after the Passover. And only recently, the temple has been a scene of a dreadful massacre, when thousands have been frightened by the sight of the Roman forces marching into the temple, and they've been crushed to death trying to escape. And soon after, not far from the city itself, the imperial messenger had been robbed by bandits, bringing furious retribution on nearby villages. And their sacred scriptures have been blasphemed and burned, and Caligula has given orders for his image to be placed in the temple. And then there's been terrible fighting between the Jews and the Samaritans, in which Rome has had to intervene, to restore law and order. Political intrigue and manoeuvring is commonplace, and there's widespread corruption in both Gentile and Jewish high places. And to cap it all, at the recent Passover, an Egyptian pseudo-messiah had succeeded in raising 30,000 followers with the promise that he would lead them to the Mount of Olives, and that Jerusalem's walls would fall down flat in front of him. Which incitement caused the procurator Felix to react with terrible ferocity, killing hundreds, taking many prisoners, while the Egyptian made good his escape. So for a number of reasons, brethren and sisters, tensions in that city were running very high indeed. So it shouldn't surprise us that as Paul made his slow, difficult, but deliberate journey towards Jerusalem by way of land and sea, from Corinth, over 4,000 miles in his journey, 4,000 kilometers rather in his journey, his companions and the brothers and sisters he met along the way were urging him to change his plans. But Paul wanted to go back to Jerusalem to deliver the collection monies that had been gathered for them, and they'd been waiting to be delivered for a long time now. And he was also taking with him representatives of the various ecclesias and the regions. Luke lists several of the people in his group travelling with him, which includes Sopater, the son of Pyrrhus, from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy from Lystra, Tychicus and Prophimus from Ephesus. And we can read about that company in Acts 20. Paul thought that he would still find some opposition in that Jerusalem ecclesia. And he hoped that the evidence of these enthusiastic Gentile Christians and the welfare collections from their ecclesias would finally put to rest doubts in the minds of Jewish Christians in Jerusalem about preaching to the Gentiles. You can trace his journey, brethren and sisters, on the map, on the handout. And you can see what a long and difficult and tortuous course he had to take. From Corinth, travelling north through Berea and Thessalonica, no doubt picking up some of those who were going to travel with him the rest of the way. And then on to Philippi and taking a boat across the sea to Troas. And then he chose, as we read in the notes you can see with that map there, to cross himself by foot from Troas across to Assos, perhaps time to reflect on what he was doing. And then he took a boat again that took him past Mytilene and down eventually, landing at Miletus. And then from Miletus, as we've read a moment ago, passing Kos or Kos and Rhodes until it came to Patara. And then a big hop of a journey from Patara right across the sea, past the island there and landing at Tyre. And then a short journey, relatively speaking, from there through Ptolemais, Caesarea, and up to Jerusalem. Now, Paul's aim was to get to Jerusalem for Pentecost. And in those days, there were no passenger ships as such. And so making a journey such as that was not something you could time very well, was it? If you wanted to travel by boat, you went to the nearest port, you found a trade ship, which was heading in the right direction, and you would then approach the captain or the ship's owner, barter a passage on that boat, and make yourself as comfortable as you could. Because being a trade ship meant that there was no cabins, there was no food. Passengers were just allotted deck space, where each night they could put up a small tent or covering to go over themselves. And passengers took and prepared their own food, which might mean taking lots of provisions if the journey was a long one, and this wasn't short. But many voyages were a series, as we've seen there, of short hops from port to port. And you can see on the map the reasons why that might be, to call in and deliver the goods that were on that trade ship and pick up more to carry them further. But it did allow the passengers perhaps to leave the ship for one night or perhaps more and find food and find shelter locally. And that's what, on occasions, as we've read, Paul and his companions tried to do. Now the chart, if you turn the map sideways and look at the chart, you can see there the details about that journey and how long it probably or possibly took. I think I quoted the wrong figure in kilometres, but it was about 1,000 or a little over 1,000 miles in total. And as you can see, somebody has suggested the dates that that would have been, given the distances that were to be travelled, and given the small amount of detail that we have in the chapters in Acts there, 20 and then on to 21, about what they were doing in each of the ports. And the longest hop, as I say, was across from Patara to Tyre, a distance of 400 miles, during which Paul and his companions would most certainly have had to feed and shelter themselves on the deck as they travelled. And so after an exhausting and no doubt an eventful journey from Corinth, lasting almost 2 months, they arrived in Jerusalem. And so on his way into the city, we read that Paul stayed with a man, Mnason of Cyprus, whom Luke called an early disciple in chapter 21 and verse 16. And it was there that, as the record says, the brothers greeted Paul warmly. So things started well. But Paul was treading carefully because he was returning to the city where he first encountered Christians and had hunted them down, remember, imprisoned them, killed them. Paul knew that the memory of that terrible time that was searing his conscience might still affect some of the members of that ecclesia. And certainly there were Jews in Jerusalem who still resented the very fact that he was preaching to the Gentiles. And they would have resented as well the fact that he had changed camp, as it were. And if we read between the lines of what went on, I think it proved to be true. The next day, when Paul goes to meet the elders of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem Ecclesia, the reception, I think, is somewhat mixed, to say the best. The account in Acts 21, verse 18 to 26, I think is just worth reading again. Acts 21, reading from verse 18. The day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And when they had saluted them, he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. So Paul got, as you might say, a word in first to point out the benefits of preaching to the Gentiles. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, there's a reservation here, I think, thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous of the law, and they are informed of thee, that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. What is it therefore? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. So in other words, they were forewarning Paul of the problems that were felt amongst some of those in the ecclesia, and certainly being felt by the Jews in the city. Now there was a problem in some respects, I suppose, that after you've travelled for 2 months and you arrive in a city, to what extent were you expected in the first place? So the multitude that we have mentioned there in verse 22 needed to know why he was there. To many of them, perhaps his arrival had been a surprise, something that they were concerned about, and they had issues with him. So as that rumour started to spread amongst the ecclesia that Paul had arrived, the advice that he was given by the elders was wise, wasn't it? Verse 23, do therefore this that we say to thee. We have 4 men which have a vow on them. Them take and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads. And the result? All may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee, the things we've been reading about in those earlier verses, are nothing, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. As an aside, brethren and sisters, it must have been a very difficult time for early ecclesias, because the traditions of the law were something that were very difficult for many of the Jewish brethren and sisters just to put to one side. And no doubt the keeping of the law was something that, to some extent at least, continued. But as time went on, and they became perhaps more comfortable with the law of Christ, then perhaps the traditions that they were so used to would have been put aside. So what happens? Paul goes through the act of purification, ritual bathing, I suppose, before entering the temple, and then pays the expenses of 4 men who have to make sacrifices for fulfilling their Nazarite vows. And that probably costs the equivalent, the suggestion is made, of, well, perhaps a month's wages, so we're not talking about a small amount of money. Perhaps it came out of the collection money that he had brought with him. But all the time, Paul was really trying to keep a relatively low profile. For the moment at least, he wasn't in danger from the Jews outside the ecclesia, as the leaders of the ecclesia were definitely on his side. It was those outside that were his main danger. And to some extent he would have been hidden, as it were, amongst the seething mass of people crowding the temple courts. But for any who observed him, he was an observant Jew. And then all of a sudden, he was noticed. Among the Jews from Ephesus and other cities of Asia, perhaps Alexander the coppersmith was one of them. Perhaps amongst all those milling around in the court of the women, someone who hated him recognized him and raised the alarm. And the news that Paul was in the temple ran in just a moment through the passionate, restless, remember how restless they must have been and how frightened they must have been and how disturbed by the recent events they must have been, but a fanatical crowd received that message and he's accused of polluting the holy place by bringing in a stranger. Now, if the accusation had been true, he would have been killed with Rome's permission. But fortunately, the Roman guards come to his rescue. There was a band of perhaps 1,000 Roman soldiers stationed in the Tower of Antonia that was at the corner of the temple precinct, looking down upon all that was going on there, strategic position to watch what was happening. And from their vantage point on top of the temple walls, they saw the trouble start, and Lysias, the commandant of the fortress of Antonia, summoned his forces and rushed down into the court. Grabbing Paul, they tie him to 2 soldiers, we read there were chains involved, and drag him out of that furious crowd. But no sooner had Paul got onto the stairs which led to the top of the cloister and so into the fortress, safety for Paul, than the mob, afraid that they are going to be denied their vengeance on Paul for something that he actually hadn't done, made another rush at him, yelling, "Kill him, kill him!" And unable to steady himself, Paul was carried off his legs and hurried along in the arms of the surrounding soldiers. And so, brethren and sisters, Paul was certainly saved from death, wasn't he, at that moment, by the fact that Lysias kept close by him. And as the rescue party is about to disappear into the barracks, Paul does something that I wonder if any of us would have dared to do. He spoke to his captor, Lysias, in Greek, and asked him leave to address that terrible mob. Now, Lysias must have been a Greek speaker, obviously. He was certainly not born a Roman, as he said later. He had to buy his citizenship. But even so, Lysias was confused because he had come to the wrong conclusion that Paul was actually that recently escaped Egyptian Messiah. But upon realizing his mistake, he allowed Paul to stop and to speak. Well, I say again, brethren and sisters, most of us, I don't think, would have been so brave. Given the chance of protection by that band of soldiers carrying us into the fortress, we would, I think, probably have let the matter take their course, get into that safety, and then explain ourselves once we were safe from the mob. But not Paul, it seems. For him, this was a fantastic preaching opportunity. And so with a motion of his arm, he silenced the crowd and spoke to them in Hebrew. And hearing him speak, there's suddenly, relatively, a silence. And so, brethren and sisters, there began a series of events that were to consider in this address and also in the next address, God willing, next month, that actually span more than 2 years, during which time Paul was kept in those chains that were attached to him that day, and periodically called before petty kings and rulers to give an account of himself of the things that he believed. And as we read in Acts, at various times he was in serious danger of his life, both from plots hatched up again by the Jews and from various rulers that he stood in front of. But out of them all, God delivered him, so that eventually he was taken to appear before Caesar in Rome. Let's have a look at the time chart on the back of the handout, the timeline, because I think we do need to understand how much time is taking place, the events, when they occurred, so that we can place them in our minds in order. So there we are, back at the top left corner, Paul arriving in Jerusalem, Acts 21, verse 17, in what we can call day one. That day, then he saw James and the elders, as we've just read. And then the next day, purifying himself with the four men, paying for their expenses, on day two. And then we get a lapse of a few days, and we get to day eight, when Paul speaks to the mob, and that first address takes place. And the uproar when Paul was in that temple area that caused him to have that opportunity, but also to be in grave danger. And then we get to the next day when Paul is called before the Sanhedrin that Lysias has called together and has to give an address, has to defend himself before the Sanhedrin, as we read in chapter 22, verse 30, and then 23, verse 1. And I think it's telling, isn't it, that Paul needed encouragement at this point, because surely there would have started to be doubts in his mind. Weary after 2 months travelling, had he made the right decision? Had he ignored the advice of his dear brethren and sisters along the way, and stubbornly, perhaps, continued on his journey to Jerusalem? Should he have stayed with them? Should he have helped them? Should he have avoided this problem? Well, all those doubts, to some extent, were put aside when Paul had reassurance from the Lord himself. And so we get into day 10, when the Jews are conspiring again to kill him. They conspire together to kill him. And we know that there was a message given to Lysias that this was taking place, and so the wise commandant on that particular occasion protected him with his vast number of troops and escorted him on his way during the night and during the next day, eventually arriving in Caesarea. And then a few more days pass by before Ananias and the elders and that lawyer, Tertullus, arrive in Caesarea to accuse Paul formally. And Paul has the opportunity on day 16 to address Felix, as we will consider in the next address. And then we have almost a hidden period, brethren and sisters, of 2 years, 2 whole years. That's a long time to be in the depths of a prison, isn't it? Wondering what each day would bring, called before Felix and Drusilla occasionally to give an account of why you're there, what you believe. But eventually those years passed, and indeed others came on the scene. And so we get to 2 years and a day when he's called before Porcius Festus, who's replaced Felix, and Festus himself then goes to Caesarea to Jerusalem, and Paul again in day two is accused before Festus. And then more days slip away and we get to day nine, and Festus returns to Caesarea, and Paul again defends himself, but uses that expression that again he must have wondered about on later occasions: I appeal to Caesar. Almost an exasperation on his part, perhaps, or was it his only way of achieving his objective of getting to Rome that he felt was where he ought to make a defence ultimately before Caesar? And so the days go by. Herod Agrippa and Bernice arrive in Caesarea, and again he has to defend himself, yet another address, the third address, until some time later, when a ship has been arranged, Paul is on his way to Rome. So those are the events that we're going to be considering over the next address as well as this one. Now, we've already touched on the political details surrounding then the earlier part of this time chart, including the occasions of the main address that Paul gave during this time that's summarised in the chapter. I feel sure that we can only see part of what actually took place on that scene in that address. As we've already illustrated, and as you can see from the chart, these were politically very unstable times, very dangerous times. But if you're interested in having more detail than I've given, I'd recommend a couple of books that are on my shelf, and perhaps they're on yours as well. One by a gentleman called Farrar, a very readable old book, called The Life of the Apostle Paul, and another one by Conybeare and Howson on Paul's life and epistles. And there are some very interesting details to be gleaned from both those books, and they themselves admit to drawing heavily upon the historian Josephus, who records many of the historic details that surround the events of Paul's visit to Jerusalem. First of all, then, let's pick up the events as they took place in that temple as Paul started to speak from the barrack steps to the Jewish mob below. Despite the terrifying events of the previous few moments, Paul was able to compose himself and give a brilliantly constructed address, I think. While telling them the truth, he carefully left out, didn't he, any unnecessary detail. And he deliberately omitted any facts which might have irritated them and which would have brought this unique opportunity to preach to a premature end. First of all, in Acts 22, verses 3 through to 5. I am verily a man which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city of Cilicia, brought up in this city, at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous towards God, as ye all are this day. And I persecuted this way, that is, the way of the Christians, unto the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. And I don't think it takes a lot of imagination, brethren and sisters, to see the nods going on in that crowd below, people saying, yes, I remember him doing that, Gamaliel being mentioned. Yes, he was drawing them in to his arguments, wasn't he? And after all, he had once shared their state of mind, their tenacity for Jewish things, hadn't he? As he puts it, zealous towards God according to Jewish traditions. But it was nothing short of divine revelation that had altered the course of his religion and his life. He was, he told them, a Jew from Tarsus, somebody at the feet of the Rabbi Gamaliel, and what's more, not merely a Jew, but a Pharisee who had studied the innermost intricacy of the law and the prophets. And like them, he was a zealot, so much so that he had persecuted the way. And if they were in any doubt, they could confirm what he said by asking the ex-high priest Theophilus, as well as many of the Sanhedrin who had given him letters to Damascus, if they doubted what he said. So evidence was there. What was it then that changed the course of his life? Nothing less than the vision that he had had from heaven of Jesus of Nazareth, which had stricken him blind, he said, forcing him to be led by the hand to Damascus, verse 6. Came to pass that as I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus about noon, suddenly there shone from heaven a great light round about me, and I fell unto the ground, heard a voice saying unto me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And I answered, Who art thou, Lord? And he said unto me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. And they that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake to me. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said unto me, Arise and go into Damascus, and there it shall be told thee of all things which are appointed for thee to do. Well, wisely, in verses 12 to 15, Paul mentions the part that Ananias played in restoring his sight, but he doesn't, if you read those verses, he doesn't call him a Christian, which was true, of course, but which would have angered that crowd. So he describes him as an orthodox observer of the law. And he then recounts word for word what Ananias had said to him about God choosing him to know his will and to see and hear the just one, the just one. Now that is an interesting phrase, brethren and sisters, because that was a phrase, an expression, the just one, that was used to describe Christ on an occasion beforehand. You can look it up at your leisure. It's in Acts 7, verse 52. Something that Paul would have found particularly poignant, given his role in Stephen's death. Well, after mentioning his baptism and his return to Jerusalem in verses 16 and 17, he hurries over the needless details, and he comes to the point that while he was worshipping, now 20 years ago, worshipping in that very temple, he had fallen into a trance and again seen the risen Jesus, who had told him to hurry out of Jerusalem, because they, the Jews, would not receive his testimony. But as we read in verse 19, he had pleaded with the heavenly vision to allow him to stay, saying that surely they would listen to someone who had been so zealous before in his persecution of the followers of Jesus. He even mentioned his role during Stephen's stoning as evidence of his righteous zeal in verse 20. Something he must now have deeply regretted and even shrunk away from remembering, let alone putting into his speech. But then he told them about the answer that had been a turning point in his career in verse 21. And he said unto me, Depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles. Well, that was the turning point of the events that we're now reading about, brethren and sisters, the fatal word Gentiles, which he had to mention at this point. And he could no longer avoid saying it, and it was all that it took to turn his attentive, even momentarily sympathetic audience back into a raging mob baying for his blood, as the next two verses tell us very clearly. As that writer Farrar describes it, then began one of the most odious and despicable spectacles which the world can witness. The spectacle of an Oriental mob, hideous with impotent rage, howling, yelling, cursing, gnashing their teeth, flinging about their arms, waving and tossing their blue and red robes, casting dust into the air by handfuls, with all the furious gesticulations of an uncontrolled fanaticism. Well, I think that scenes like that are quite familiar to us today, brethren and sisters, as we often see similar scenes, I think, in the news, in reports from the Middle East. Do you know what I mean? Where crowds are easily worked up into a frenzy and capable of tremendous violence, something that perhaps we're not quite so familiar with in this country. Well, fortunately, a line of Roman swords separated Paul from the mob. And amidst the great excitement, Lysias ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks, and almost before Paul knew what was happening, he was safe from the crowd inside the barracks. But with his hands being tied yet again and his back bared ready to be scourged. Well, fortunately, I think, Paul had enough breath left in his body to make a simple question heard among all that shouting. Verse 25, as they bound him with thongs, Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned? And once it was realized by Lysias that Paul was a Roman citizen, Paul was untied and the scourges were put quickly aside. But his trouble was not over. Although Lysias had been shaken by the fact that he had very nearly committed the crime of scourging an untried Roman citizen, a mistake, by the way, which could have cost him his job or even his life, he realized that he could not leave the matter unresolved. Anxious to rid his hands of this very awkward business in a city where any excuse always seemed to lead to the most terrible consequences and where trouble had been brewing over the last few weeks, if not months, and had been erupting on numerous occasions, verse 30 records how he told the chief priest to summon a meeting of the Sanhedrin the next day in order to try Paul. Now, if for a moment, brethren and sisters, we might be tempted to think that such a trial could lead to Paul's just acquittal, then we've overlooked the historical facts of the circumstances of that day. Leading the Sanhedrin was the high priest Ananias, the son of Nebodius, who had been appointed, apparently, by Herod of Chalcis. Now, this man was one of the worst, if not the very worst specimen of the worldly Sadducees in an age which was one of the worst in history. He was a rapacious tyrant, historians tell us, who, in his gluttony and his greed, reduced the inferior priests almost to starvation by defrauding them of their tithes, sending his henchmen to the threshing floors to seize the tithes for himself by force. And he held office for an unusually long period, interrupted only by his absence as a prisoner to answer for his misconduct at Rome. And when at last his vile actions caught up with him, apparently he hid in a sewer, only to be dragged out and murdered by Jewish zealots. And as I read that, brothers and sisters, the vision of Saddam Hussein hiding in a sewer came to my mind. Perhaps it did to yours. This then was the judge in charge of Paul's trial. The judge in charge of Paul's trial. Scarcely had Paul opened his defense with the words that we read in chapter 23, verse 1, Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience to this day, than Ananias ordered him to be struck on his mouth. Does that really sound like a high priest of any real repute? Knowing what we do about the man, we cannot condemn Paul's reaction for one moment, I think. Neither perhaps should we be surprised at the order that he gave. After all, here was very likely a man with a bad conscience, so Paul's opening remarks had touched a raw nerve. This was certainly a whitewashed wall, if ever there was one, that God would judge severely for his evil deeds. And yet a moment later, I think we can respect Paul because he apologized for his outburst. Once he realized who the speaker was, not so much the man, but what he stood for, surely. There are a number of reasons why Paul might not have known that he was a high priest initially, as Farrar explains, if you want to look into it. But once he did know, he was obedient to the law that said he must not speak evil of the ruler of God's people, however unworthy Ananias was of such an office. Perhaps there's a lesson there for us, brethren and sisters, in how we speak of those in authority over us. That we should not be the source of criticism, however much we might despise their actions or indeed their words. God has put in charge over us people for a purpose, and therefore it's not for us to condemn them, whatever our feelings about them. So yes, this was a kangaroo court, if ever there was one. This was not the place for Paul to be either acquitted or condemned, was it? This was no more than a stopping point, and rightly so, on the way to further opportunities for Paul to witness to the truth. And so these events could not end soon enough, I think. Which is perhaps why the Spirit must have guided Paul to say what he did say next. Chapter 23, verse 6 tells us that Paul saw a way of dividing the jury right down the middle by saying that he too was a Pharisee who believed in the resurrection of the dead, which the rest of the Sanhedrin, who were Sadducees, did not. And this comment had exactly its desired effect, perhaps even more so than Paul expected, for a riot broke out, and down came the chief captain Lysias again with his troops to drag Paul to safety. Well, the following night, Paul was given the reasons for the events that had happened to him so far in Jerusalem, as chapter 23 and verse 11 tells us. The Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me at Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." So Paul knew that it was God's will that he should make that long journey to the peril that had faced him in Rome. But not before he was called upon to defend himself yet again, and this time before Felix and again before Agrippa. Looking back over the relatively short time that had elapsed since he left Corinth, remember we're yet to have that period when he's in prison for 2 years, Paul must have asked himself whether he had done the right thing in coming to Jerusalem. After all, he could have broken his journey for longer, couldn't he? He could have stopped with those brethren and sisters that he'd met with along the way, spent time with them, encouraged them, been encouraged by them, knowing, as we do, his deep concern for all the young ecclesias that he'd only recently established. Might he now have doubted the wisdom of his actions, even though the Lord had appeared and told him that the future lay for him in Rome? The tears of his brothers and sisters when he left them behind were, as it were, still damp on his shoulder. Might it have been better for him to remain a free man, he asked himself, surely, visiting and supporting those ecclesias rather than suffering as a Roman prisoner? Yes, how much he must have needed that angelic message to tell him he had made the right choice. And now he could repeat his own words with even greater confidence, couldn't he, in chapter 21, verse 13. "I am ready, not to be bound only, but also to die for the name of the Lord Jesus." Brethren and sisters, in a similar way, life brings choices in our lives too, doesn't it? Causing us to make decisions, some of which have profound effects on the course of our lives. And while our lives are far, far easier than Paul's life, and we're fortunate to live in a country ruled by just laws and governments that are sympathetic to our beliefs, allowing us to be here in peace and quiet tonight, we still need to seek guidance, don't we, at times, if we are to make the right decisions. Decisions either for ourselves or for our brethren and sisters and our ecclesias. So like Paul, we need to be alert, don't we? Alert to God's guidance, whether through prayer or by a perceptive reading of his word. And only then will our journey be blessed in the same way as Paul's journey was blessed. The rest of chapter 23 gives us the details about how it was that Paul left then Jerusalem for the last time. He was taken by night the 35 miles to Antipatris under the guard of no less than 200 legionaries, 70 cavalry soldiers, 200 lancers. It's ridiculous, really, isn't it? And then the following morning, another 25 miles to Caesarea, where he at once was brought before Procurator Felix. And that, brethren and sisters, is where we're going to continue our study of Acts next month, God willing.